Rightio, let's have a look at church history, looking at social concerns. Church history, social concern. Following up the Great Awakening of the 1720s through to 1770s, really from that time on, from the time of the Great Awakening, 1720s, to the 1770s, about a period of 50 years, from that period there really hasn't been a time since when there haven't been, or hasn't been at some place, a revival. And there's been, as it were, revivals leapfrogging the years from the time of the Great Awakening all the way through to the present. And of course, as communication between different lands has increased, so of course the effect of something that happens in one place overflows into another. If you open your Erdmann's Encyclopedia of Church History to page 512, you have a very good article by Michael Hennell on the evangelicals. And we have the revival at Redruth in Cornwall, which continued for 9 successive days in 1814, and the quote there of the revival meeting: hundreds were crying for mercy at once. Some remained in great distress of soul for 1 hour, some for 2, some 6, some 9, 12 and 15 hours before the Lord spoke peace in their souls. Then they would rise, extend their arms and proclaim the wonderful works of God with such energy that bystanders would be struck in a moment and fall to the ground and roar for the disquieture of their souls. Now here's the Holy Spirit really coming in power in a way that we would perhaps associate today with a Pentecostal revival. But this becomes more and more common as the Great Awakening moves in to its second phase. Remember Jonathan Edwards and some of the other preachers. Jonathan Edwards was very reasonable and very orderly in his approach. Whitfield was a bit more fiery. Some of the others were very fiery. With some of the Wesley's messages, with Whitfield's messages, people did fall to the ground. But it was the exception rather than the rule in the early Great Awakening. But by the end of the 18th century, by the 1790s and 1800s, a phenomenon known as the camp meetings had started. And we'll look at those the next session, next week. But as the camp meetings started, you have a tremendous outpouring of what we would associate today with the Pentecostal movement. But God worked mightily upon the people and through the men involved in this area. On page 513, the extreme right-hand column, there is a record of the impact of the evangelical societies. The evangelical societies made it their business to supply evangelical ordinands and endow evangelical parishes where they might serve. Now what do they mean here? They mean that the evangelical societies would underwrite a Bible college, as it were, like this one. I think this is where there's a tremendous example from the past to the present. There are many people in this country who are giving their money into all sorts of different causes. If they concentrated their giving in an area where it could really do some good, there would be a tremendous impact in this land. And what these evangelical societies did, there were many wealthy men, many lords and ladies were members of this. The Countess of Huntingdon was, of course, one of them. And many of these people concentrated their vast fortunes, millions of dollars. And what they would do is they would train men in evangelical preaching. They would find a person who had a real strong biblical faith and they would pay for them to be trained. And having paid for them to be trained, they would then subsidize their wages in a church that they might serve. So in a church that the Church of England officially wasn't interested in, these people would pay the minister for a period of time to establish a church in that area. Now that's tremendous giving. That's targeting. That's giving and then being able to see blessing. Because you're paying for one person, and then you're following that person right through to his ministry. You're putting him in the ministry. You're paying the person to stay there as a missionary. Your missionary. And you can then share in the work, both financially and by prayer, and then when the blessing comes, by blessing. And that's what they did. The most important patronage trust was that begun by John Thornton and taken over by the Reverend Charles Simeon. When Simeon died, the Simeon Trust had the right to nominate the clergy to 21 Anglican positions. These were mainly in large towns such as Bradford and Derby. By 1820, 1 in 20 of the Anglican clergy were evangelical. By 1830, it was 1 in 8. Now that's the impact these men had on the Anglican Church. They would go to a bishop and they'd say to the bishop, "Okay, bishop, you can't afford to put ministers into these parish churches. We will put the men in, but we want to choose them, and we'll pay for everything." And of course the bishops, who mostly were liberal, or very dead, at least if not liberal, were only too happy to have the financial burden lifted and to have an evangelical priest there, because there might as well be an evangelical priest, at least we're not paying for him. And the impact on the Anglican Church was extensive. As you can see, now it's obviously not, they didn't get the majority. It's only 1 in 10 and then 1 in 8. 9 others, or should I say in one case, or 7 others. So you have 7 liberals and 1 evangelical. So, well, you know, that's not pretty, that's not good. Well, it's an awful lot better than 8 liberals. And what they did, they targeted the parishes in the middle of the city and worked among the poor people and really preached up a revival, or shall I say, they prayed down and preached up. They prayed down and they preached up the revival. So in Great Britain, this revival movement was encouraged within the Anglican Church and also, of course, independently among the Baptist and the Brethren, but we'll get to them in a minute. But it had great impact. And it was centred in a group called the Clapham Sect. And this group of people met in the village of Clapham from the 1780s to the 1830s. And they were very wealthy men and women, and they planned how best to have impact on their society, in their churches, and in their world. And Shelley on page 387 covers them. In fact, it may pay Michael just to whip out and check, see how the boys are. They're looking for Michael Moimoi. I think Uncle Michael, so I'll send one Uncle Michael out and see if you can help him. Okay, page 387. Now, one of the great things that these people did was get involved in the real issues of the day, and the issues for the Clapham community were their abhorrence of slavery within the British Empire and poverty and the problems of the poor. The terrible trouble that people had, the labourers, and I'll be looking at it in another lecture, so I don't want to go on to it too much here, but the treatment of working people was absolutely criminal and awful. It was something which the Lord Jesus Christ himself had preached against, which the entire Bible was opposed to, the treatment of workers as if they're things, and killing them without any worry, just terrible things. And these people got together, the many of them wealthy, they studied, the leader of it, the group was of course Henry, you've got Henry Thornton, who we referred to in the Erdman's article, and then of course Charles Simeon, he's another, but the leader was William Wilberforce, who became the great parliamentarian. But he gathered around a large group of people, John Shaw, who was Lord Teignmouth, the Governor General of India, Sir Charles Grant, Chairman of the East India Company, Charles Grant was Chairman of the East India Company, John Shaw was the Governor General of India, James Stevens, who was Under Secretary for the Colonies, Zachary Macaulay, who was the editor of the Christian Observer, Thomas Clarkson, who was the great abolitionist, many others. Now these are key people within the Anglican Church and within the British government. Key people. And this man had tremendous impact, Wilberforce. At 25 he had been saved, and saved wonderfully. He had tremendous natural ability which the Lord used mightily. And as Shelley points out in the last paragraph before the next section on page 387, under Wilberforce's leadership, the Clapham Friends were gradually knit together in intimacy and solidarity. At the Clapham Mansions, they held what they chose to call their cabinet councils. What they would do is they just bought up almost the village of Clapham and built houses there, and they lived in a sort of extended community, even though they may have worked in England, in London, but they tried to live as close as they could to one another, and they got together and they acted like a parliament in exile. They really, even though they were involved politically, they also were involved spiritually. And they got together and they prayed about the situation in England. They asked the Lord to guide them as to what they should do. And the Lord guided them mightily and powerfully enabled them to change things in the British Empire that otherwise would not have been able to be changed so quickly. And they discussed the wrongs, the injustices of their country, the battles they would need to fight, and what they had to do in Parliament and how they would do it. And out of that came the host of societies at the bottom of the page. And this wasn't just liberal social action. Now, Shelley's a great social action guy, and in a later chapter I'll have cause to point out Shelley's nonsense, because Shelley is quite hooked on social action. Now, the Clapham community were not hooked on social action as such. They were impressed by the power of God's word, the power of prayer, and also the need to meet people's physical needs as they were meeting their spiritual needs. But out of that group came the Church Missionary Council in 1799, the British and Foreign Bible Society in 1804, the Society for Bettering the Conditions of the Poor in 1897, the Society for the Reformation of Prison Discipline, and many others. Whenever they knew there was a Christian cause where Christians could raise their voice and claim God's word and give the gospel at the same time, they established a little subgroup of the community, called it a society, got everybody behind it, and went out there and did something. And so the reform of the prisons, providing help to the poor, helping orphans and widows, getting the Bible out through the Bible Society, establishing the first British missionary society, all of these things were done by these people. Now the slave trade had been started really by the English, and in 1562 there was an Englishman, Sir John Hawkins, who took a cargo of slaves from Sierra Leone to Saint Domingo in the West Indies. And after the monarchy was restored in 1660, Charles gave a charter to a company to take 3,000 slaves a year to the West Indies. And the slave trade really boomed from then. And 110 years later, in 1770, 100,000 slaves a year were being carried on British ships across in what was known as the Triangle Trade. The Triangle Trade meant that they would take a shipment of clothing and other things down to Africa. They would take slaves from Africa across to America, and then they would take cotton and other things from America across to Britain. And of course they would make a profit on each run, and it was a great and terrible evil that was done. Now, the Clapham community threw themselves into this, and Wilberforce in 1789 made his first speech to the House of Commons, which is recorded there on page 388, and he called on the House of Commons to abolish slavery And he realized pretty quickly, though, that there was a lot of commercial interest involved here. And so stage by stage, the Clapham community changed public opinion regarding the slave trade by preaching the Christian message regarding slavery. And of course, while the scriptures recognizes slavery as an institution, it also recognizes the equality of men, and that if you have a slave, you shouldn't treat him like an animal. He should be treated as your brother. And so one of the things that was done by these people was to change public opinion, to show them that the Christian view of slavery was such that in the end you'd have to abolish it, because you'd transform it so that it was no longer slavery. It was a relationship of equals. So there's a tremendous impact in the area of slavery. Now in James chapter 2, they really would take a passage like this as their motto, and this was what galvanized them into action. James 2 verses 14 to 17. What does it profit, my brothers, though a man say he has faith and has not works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, notwithstanding you give them not these things, what does it needful to the body? What does it profit? If you don't give people things that they need for their body, what does it profit if you've given them the gospel? Nothing. You must do both. Faith without works is dead, being alone. And they took James 1, 26 and 27 seriously. Pure religion and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. That holiness and concern for the poor go hand in hand, that you can't be holy and not concerned for widows and orphans. If you claim to be holy and living a spiritual life and you aren't concerned for the victims of evil in society, you are not holy. You're a hypocrite. And so they took that very seriously, and they didn't preach sermons only, they planned a campaign to change things. And the end of the slave trade really came in, as Shelley records on page 389, on the 23rd of February 1807. Opposition started to buckle, and finally the end came on the 25th of July 1833, just 4 days before Wilberforce died. But he gave his life to make sure that slaves would be in the British Empire set free. So tremendous approach by these people. They didn't only go after social issues, but they set an example of how to combine social action and evangelism without detrimentally affecting either. Now many people today can get one right without the other. There are many good evangelical Christians who are great on the gospel and on missionary activity, but they haven't the concern to help the people who they've saved. And so you've got people who will lead a crusade, lead people to Christ, and you've got the glue sniffers and the alcoholics and all sorts of people saved, and then they try to put them into, get them to join local churches and basically leave them, and they've got nowhere to live, they've got no food, they've got no jobs. And unless there's a follow-up that deals with the physical needs of those people, really you haven't done them, well, you've done them a lot of good spiritually, but you are a hypocrite, because you're not then concerned about them as a brother or a sister to be able to help them physically. And so it's a matter of getting the two together. But then you've got the other extreme in the liberal churches, where they go all out for social action, but there's no gospel. There's only a social gospel, which is of course no gospel at all. Because it doesn't matter whether a person is fit, healthy, wealthy and well-fed going to hell, or whether they're unfit, unhealthy, badly fed and badly clothed going to hell, they're still going to hell. So the gospel of salvation has got to be preached, and it's spiritual salvation, not physical salvation. But having dealt with the spiritual issue, the physical issue should be dealt with. And James calls any Christian who won't deal with the physical issue a hypocrite. Now, with the great movement that was happening in the churches, on page 521 in Erdmann's Encyclopedia, you have the movement in this area with the orphans, among the brethren, and of course you've got the two great brethren men who organized the orphanages, Thomas Barnardo, and Barnardo was one of the great brethren men of the years of the 19th century. You've got the other great brethren man, Müller. You've also got another man, Tregellis, and all these men were very active in looking after the poor, and tremendous results were achieved. And it's interesting that the brethren, although they were called the Plymouth Brethren, but they really are descended from the Anglican evangelicals. And remember, I pointed out that early on what happened was that the evangelicals would get bishops to appoint priests in various places to lead churches in areas the Anglican Church wasn't interested in. They had a church there, but they didn't have anyone to fill it. It was a city parish. Well, in many of those places, the people who were saved through the ministry of these people became convinced that the Anglican system was not the godly system, and often they seceded and became a brethren assembly. And so the brethren church really is established in Britain last century as an offshoot of Anglicanism, as nearly all the others are also. So your Baptists, Methodists, even the Presbyterians are all offshoots of the Anglican Church of England or Church of Scotland. You have a real emphasis on Bible teaching within the Brethren movement, and you have two groups of brethren. You have the exclusive brethren assemblies, and they would only fellowship with their own, and they still survive today. Very legalistic, very authoritarian, absolutely kill the life out of their people. If you ever see very dour looking women wearing scarves and looking dull as doormats, that you're probably 9 times out of 10 or 99% you've got a closed brethren before you. They tend to be fairly wealthy. They do practice a tithing system, very authoritarian. The women are really treated like chattels. It's a terrible sort of a system, and there's a lot of funny doctrines involved as well now since this time. But then also you have the Open Brethren, now a different group altogether, and the Open Brethren of course are very well known here for their evangelism and for their emphasis on Bible teaching. And so this begins here, and as I say, many of these early brethren men were very, very active in caring for those in need. If you turn back a couple of pages in your Erdmann's Encyclopedia to 516, the marvellous photo there of the early Salvation Army, the 1880s, and one of the earlier photos of the Salvation Army, the Cornwall Band of the Salvation Army in 1880. And General Booth, or the William Booth, as he was initially, began his own Christian mission in a tent in Whitechapel in London in 1865. Now, he was a man who had been involved in the Wesleyan movement in the Methodist Church, and he was involved with them for a while, but then eventually set up on his own specifically to target the needy, the people who were not being reached by anyone else. And that's one of the great things about the Lord's movement, the Spirit's movement among believers last century. These organizations were set up specifically, these churches were founded specifically to meet the needs that were not being met by other groups. And so the Salvation Army, one of the great evangelistic pushes from last century, they were founded by these people, by the Booths, both Booth, Mr. Senior and his daughters, and they really set themselves up as an army. And it's still organized on army lines. In fact, if you're in the Salvation Army, you are either a soldier, you're either in the ranks, or you're an officer. And if you're an officer, you can't marry someone in the ranks. It's that tough. So that if you like a girl, you see a girl down there singing in the choir, and you happen to be a second lieutenant in the Salvation Army, and she's a private, and unless she's officer material, you can forget her. You won't be able to marry her. And when the offering comes round, you're firing bullets for the Lord. That's what you're doing, and you put your bullets on the plate. That's your offering. Everything's very military. Those who've seen it in operation, it can make you smile. But I'll tell you what, this mighty power has been released through that. And Booth, by keeping that military organization, eliminated all the pretenders. And that was a great thing about the Salvation Army. It eliminated the pretenders. Those who were playing with faith didn't touch the Salvation Army, because those people made a stand on alcoholism, they made a stand on prostitution and just about every other vice, and they walked right into the middle of the worst places, and they were beaten up, they were abused, they were killed. There were many martyrs in the early Salvation Army in the middle of London. And in a later lecture, I'll give you some figures on the number of people. And I'll give you an indication. 5 to 7 people were found dead on the street in London every night in the 1860s. An equal number were found dead from suicide. In other words, there were murders and suicides. And this is over 100 years ago in London. Now, it's not even as bad as that today. Now, this was a real, absolute hellhole, these inner cities. And Booth's men and women went right into the middle of them in their uniforms, so they stood out. So they were a target for attacks. And they were beaten, they were killed, and they kept coming back and preaching. And they had impact. They practiced prayer, and some of the greatest believers I've met have been Salvation Army people. However, the army today is moving into liberalism in some areas. Now, there's still some really good core of Salvation Army throughout the country, and really sound in the faith. But sadly, there is a move into more social gospel in some Salvation Army circles, and in fact, it may even be in the majority now. But for over 100 years, they have really set the pace for people who practice evangelism and social concern and get it right, get the balance right. They have touched people that no one else would touch, and they did it with real conviction. Now, they were bitterly opposed. In fact, even old Spurgeon didn't like the Salvation Army. But one great thing about Spurgeon is he didn't criticize them. His attitude was, well, let's see what the Lord will do with this group. I think there's a great message in that. I'm often convicted by the Lord that I'm a bit too quick to criticize some. I'm learning now. I'm becoming less and less critical, because I'm learning the lesson Spurgeon learned. If the Lord is in it, it'll prosper. If the Lord isn't in it, it won't. If the devil's in it, you'll see by the false doctrine. You can expose the false doctrine, but forget about the movement. Concentrate on the word. Don't concentrate on the people. Don't hit personalities. Just get the job done. And these people really got the job done, and in the end, even old Spurgeon was impressed by the work of the Salvation Army. Now, one of the things that the Salvation Army, of course, were very strong on was music. And they used music, and they did something which was a bit shocking to a lot of people. They used street music. Now, brass bands last century were the equivalent of pop today. And so basically, Today, when the Salvation Army band plays, you just think, oh, it's a brass band. But last century, a brass band was basically pop music. And so what these people did was they took Christian message, added a pop treatment, and they played the Christian message with the pop treatment on the streets, and people listened. Same as today. You go on the streets and sing a hymn in, say, use a Wagnerian music and get a pipe organ and play a hymn, some people will listen. But you go and play the same lyrics with a new musical treatment, just about everyone will stop and listen, won't they? Now, you see, Booth was sensible. His attitude was, use music as the hook. And play the music and get everybody to stop and listen, and they'll hear the lyrics are different. And they'll start tapping their foot to the beat, and they'll start thinking about the words, and they'll say, hey, they're Christian words. They're talking about Jesus. What's all this about? And then, of course, as soon as the music stopped, there was no pregnant pause. There wasn't 3 seconds while people put their tubas down and got organized. They didn't lose their crowd. The second the last beat was out, the man who was ready to preach was straight up onto his soapbox, and literally it was a soapbox, it was just a little wooden box, and he'd just get up on it, head above the crowd, and start preaching the gospel. And people were saved. Surprise, surprise. They had the message. They prayed. They prayed before they did everything. They prayed while they were doing it. They had the prayer warriors. In fact, they had their cause organized. They had people praying. They had people playing. They had people preaching. They had the 3 P's. The prayer, the playing, and the preaching. And they grew. In a couple of years, there were several 100,000 members of the Salvation Army. And their impact in the slums of Britain, in places, in darkest Britain, as William Booth called it, rather than darkest Africa, he said Britain was worse than Africa. He said the darkness of the Congo is nothing to the darkness of London. And they went where no one else would go, and the Lord mightily blessed them. Now there was another movement, and that was the Tent Movement, and I've referred to that, and we'll look at it next week in the Second Great Awakening in the American West, and we'll cover it in a bit more detail. There's a lot of overlap here in the next 3 lectures. But the Tent Meetings, which led to what we even know in New Zealand as the Keswick Conventions. Now they've since stopped here, but Ngarawahia Camp used to always be the home of the Keswick camp meetings. And they were a tremendous source of strength for many of the Baptist and Brethren peoples through the 30s and 40s and 50s in this country. And the tent meetings begin in Britain, late last century also. And some of these things are mentioned by Cairns. Cairns notes, the Keswick and Victorious Life meetings each summer first began under the leadership of Canon Hartford Battersby in 1875. So you've got a Church of England source, an evangelical member of the Church of England. These meetings appealed to Christians in all denominations. Preaching emphasized the experience of instantaneous and progressive sanctification that would enable one to defeat sin and live victorious. The Keswick type of meeting spread in centres to the United States, to Canada, and, of course, to New Zealand, Australia, and virtually everywhere else. Also, another sort of revival movement was beginning in this time. In 1859, another revival movement related to the lay prayer revival of 1857 and 1858 in the United States swept England, reviving the churches and promoting social reform. So what happened in America as one of these waves of revival is that it wasn't led by ministers, and that's one of the key things to understand in church history. Most of the great revivals didn't start with a minister. They started with ordinary church people gathering for prayer. And the thing took off and exploded. And we'll look at that once again also next week. We'll see some things there. There were great revivals in Wales. The preaching of Evan Roberts, preaching of Edwin Orr, and others in Scotland and various other places. My own grandfather on my father's side, and my grandmother, I remember talking to my grandmother many years ago, used to chat to her about her memories of the 1890s in Scotland. And of course, she was a very old lady when she died a couple of years ago, and she had a tremendous memory. Old people can often remember things from their childhood. They can't remember something that happened last week, but they can remember something that happened 90 years ago. And that's just one of the factors of memory. You get a short-term memory loss, but they get memory back from early times. And if you know any old people in your family in their 80s, you should sit down and have a good chat to them, because you'll learn more history from them than you learn from a book. And my grandmother told me about the tent meetings held in Scotland in the 1890s and the revivals, and someone would just put up a tent on this frozen bit of ground in Scotland, and thousands of people. And my grandfather, my father's father, was a coal miner, and they were hard men. They lived hard. They got up in the morning and their breakfast was a mug of Scottish whiskey. And they had to have a mug of Scottish whiskey, because that got their blood going and kept them alive on the walk from home to the pit. Then they could have a bite to eat as they went down. That warmed them up in the freezing cold morning. Now you start, I remember we inherited, when he died, we inherited a bottle of this old par, which stayed there for a long, long time, because of course it wasn't drunk very much in our family, of course. But he became a great believer, this man. He became a great believer through those 10 meetings. And he was converted there. My grandmother was converted in the 10 meetings. And how are they converted? Well, traveling evangelists. Men from Spurgeon's seminary, men who had trained with him, traveled around, preaching, teaching. And of course you've got men like Edward Irving in Scotland, the Scottish Presbyterian. And he established a group called the Irvingites. And of course they were very much like the Pentecostal today. They practiced speaking in tongues. But there was tremendous revival there. There were others. You've got George Williams establishing the YMCA, which was established not as a meeting place for homosexuals, which it tends to be today, but as a Christian organization for Bible study and physical activity. You've got Spurgeon, who preaches from about 1850 to 1892 when he died. And he preached and preached, and he just kept moving from larger to larger church. And then by 1861, he moved into the Metropolitan Tabernacle. It had 4,700 seats. 4,700 seats, the Metropolitan Tabernacle. And it was filled 3 to 4 to 5 times a week. 15,000 people were saved and added to his church by 1891. In 30 years, 15,000 people joined the church. His pastor's college, which he established to train ministers, some of whom went north and of course were involved in the conversion of my own grandfather and grandmother, he trained 900 ministers in his college before he died. You see, there's a tremendous movement of the Spirit on these people throughout this period of time. And in Erdman's Encyclopedia 529, you've got a picture of Spurgeon there as a young man standing. He's only 21 there, standing to preach. And he was a Baptist preacher, but he went independent because the Baptist Union in Britain went liberal. And he just saw it was going liberal. He saw the signs and he moved away and went independent. And then the other man of the moment was D.L. Moody. And if you turn to 536, you've got a picture there of Moody with Sankey on the stage also. Sankey being the organist. Of course, in New Zealand we had the Sankey singers. in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Most of you wouldn't remember that. Some of us old people remember the Sankey Singers. My father was one of the Sankey Singers, I think, in the 1930s. He told me about that. Uncle Tom, was it Tom Garland? And of course, and I got to know him through one of his grandsons, who was my age. And old Uncle Tom Garland, he led the Sankey Singers here. They took their music from Ira Sankey, Sankey being the man who played the organ for D.L. Moody. Moody, what did Moody do? Well, he travelled throughout America, Britain, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, preaching the gospel, preaching a great revival. Read about Moody. Read what he did, read what he said. But also, what did Moody do? Moody founded the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And the Moody Press grew out of that. So notice, once again, you see, the evangelical revival went in different directions all at once. And that's the point I want to make here. Our Bible college is not an isolated unit. We are related to the church. We are here to serve not only Christ for all, but to serve all churches that need evangelical Bible teachers, pastors, evangelists, missionaries. But we've also got to remember that there is a publishing function and there is a social function. So that every evangelical revival should be associated with several things. It should be associated with the salvation of the lost, with the protection of the innocent, and the help, practical help for the destitute. It should be associated with training a new generation of ministers to multiply the ministry. So that instead of one man going around evangelizing, that one man keeps evangelizing, but as he evangelizes, he trains up other evangelists. So that within 2 or 3 years, another 10 have gone out. And then another 10, and you just keep multiplying your ministry. And then you also get involved in publishing good literature. And all these people were involved in that. Spurgeon is involved in that. Moody's involved. Mayer, one of the other preachers of Spurgeon's day, is involved. Producing good Bible study material to help spread the revival. So you see, when we're thinking of revival, we're not just praying down a movement of the Spirit on our church. We're praying for a thorough movement of God in all areas. So that there's a full, well-rounded impact in our society. Okay, so with a tremendous emphasis on revival, there was also a corresponding interest on the part of some in the liberal camp on the contemplative mystery type stuff of Catholicism. And so Shelley brings that out with the Oxford movement at the bottom of 389. And now he calls it a Christian movement. I'm of two minds on this whole business. I would almost think it's a satanic counterattack to the evangelical revival. Because what happened was, men like John Henry Newman and others within the Anglican Church were initially evangelical. But then the evangelical ardor cooled and they moved more into religious contemplation, and many of them got involved in Catholicism and started to get attracted by the monastic ideals and by the attitude and everything of the Roman Catholic Church. And as he said at the bottom of page 390, the Oxford men, these men of the Oxford group, felt that the Church of England needed to affirm that its authority did not rest on the authority from the state. It came from God. And of course, once they said that, they then had to say that if it came from God, in what channel did it come? Well, of course, a strict evangelical answer is it comes in the power of the Spirit through the Word of God. That there's not a human channel, it's a divine channel, God's Word, God's Spirit. But these men were church historians, and so they went back through the bishops. And they said the channel of God's authority comes through the bishops. Well, once you accept that, it's a very small step in church history to go to the Bishop of Rome and say, finally, we should all be part of the Roman Church. Also, they were hooked on public worship as being something that was strongly symbolic and of value in and of itself. And halfway down page 391, Shelley hits the nail on the head here. Public worship was vital to the Oxford men. They believed strongly in the religious value of symbolic actions in worship, such as turning towards the altar, bending the knee, elevating the cross. The worship of God, they said, demands the total response of man. So ritual should appeal to the senses. Rich clerical garments, incense on the altar, music by trained voices. In short, Tractarian Christianity was a zealous version of high church Christianity. What they were looking for was not what you and I would look for, which is the movement of the Spirit upon the people of God through the Word of God. They were looking at very much stylized worship. Well, once again, they're moving towards Rome. And as Shelley points out, step by step, the Oxford men move towards the Church of Rome. And finally, in 1841, Newman wrote an article saying that really the 39 articles of the Church of England were not necessarily Protestant. They could be interpreted in the spirit of the Catholic Church. And he believed that a Catholic could still be a good Anglican, or an Anglican could be a good Catholic. And everybody was up in arms then and said, well, who are you people and what is it all about? And in 1845, Newman became a Roman Catholic. So John Henry Newman became a Catholic. 875 ministers left the Church of England with him. So that's how powerful an effect he had. There were 250 ministers or theologians in the Oxford movement, and they too left the Church of England and became Catholics. And of course, John Henry became, in 1877, John Henry Cardinal Newman. Now, you'll still find very, very good hymns in the hymn book written by John Henry Newman. In his early years, and even his latter years, he wrote excellent hymns. But as far as I'm concerned, he's an enigma. Because how can a man who has evangelistic beliefs become, in the end, a Roman Catholic cardinal supporting a pope who was the most reactionary and an authoritarian and ungodly man you could find? Well, he was very holy in the Catholic sense, but he wasn't really a born-again believer at all. And yet there's every indication in Henry Newman's writing that he was. So I think what we have here is Satan's counterblast. You've got the evangelicals within the Anglican Church really doing something. You've got the Baptists doing something. You've got men like Spurgeon preaching up a storm. You've got F.B. Meyer preaching. You've got the Brethren Assemblies standing for the truth, the Salvation Army. And yet you've got these men sitting in their Oxford colleges going into Catholicism. Well, surprise, surprise, it's no accident that just 1 month ago, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Church, went and had Mass with the Pope in Rome. The Anglican Church is now in the process of going back into Catholicism. And there is a bit of disquiet amongst some Anglican ministers who are truly evangelical. And we may see a coming out from the Anglican Church in the next few years. As a result of all these things, what happened was a great missionary outburst. In fact, just pause here, because also the Church of England today, I should make a comment here, the Church of England today is very much divided into high church and low church. And in the Church of England, you've got tremendous evangelical strength still. And it goes back to these days. It goes right back to the Clapham movement. And since the days of the Clapham movement, early last century, there's been a small group of evangelicals within the Anglican Church. About 1 in 8 ministers then, probably 1 in 8 still today. Real committed evangelicals. And you could go to their church services and get a real blessing and talk to them. They are born again believers committed to the Lord. Interestingly enough, they never get promoted in the Anglican Church. There's only one of them I know of became a bishop, and that was the Bishop of Nelson. And he's an interesting, he was an interesting character. I don't know even whether it's the same guy still, I've lost track. But he wouldn't accept anyone from St. John's College in his area. You had to have gone to the Bible College of New Zealand before he would ordain anyone as a minister in his parish. And so Nelson is still very much an Anglican evangelical stronghold. The Bishop of Sydney in Australia is also, also a very strong evangelical. And so the Sydney Anglicans are very evangelistic. But overall, the Anglican Church is very much in the high church, very close to Catholicism, and very much into liberalism in many areas. And in Australia, the Melbourne College of Divinity and the Australian College of Theology, both MCD and ACT, the two big colleges, are either in liberalism or high church Anglo-Catholicism. So just be aware, be watching the Anglican Church, be reading articles about it in the paper over the next few months, because big changes are coming in that area, and they're going to have quite an impact on the local New Zealand scene. Okay, missionary activity is another thing that burst out in this period of time, and it was a result of the evangelical movement. And of course on page 533 of your Edmunds Encyclopedia, you have a short article on the worldwide vision of the missionary activity, and the whole mission thing takes off at this point. So I hope I've given you a glimpse of what's happening here next week on the tape study. As I say, I'll be here for the first lecture next week, but then we'll put a tape on for the second and third, and we'll look at the Second Great Awakening, and you'll find there's quite a lot of overlaps between these two. We've concentrated on the social concerns this time, how the evangelical push was joined together with the social action without compromising either. Next week we'll look at the Second Awakening in the spiritual area only and show the impact it had in the social realm, just spiritually in the social realm. So we'll get a contrast and perhaps even some apparent contradictions next week. Let's take a short break. And if anyone's brought their notes for me to check, I'll do that right now. Remember, today, if you've got notes, let me look at them. I want to see your notes, if I don't see them today, on Tuesday or Thursday night, or next Saturday before the lectures. Okay, anyone's...